Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. Have you ever wondered what is consciousness? Is it in all living beings? What happens when we die? All these questions about consciousness, it's been one of the greatest mysteries of humanity since the beginning. And today's guests go deep down the rabbit hole of consciousness in their new film, Aware: Glimpses of Consciousness. Today's guests are Frauke Sandig and Eric Black. And we had a fantastic conversation about consciousness and asking the really, really big questions about life. And I'm not sure if we answered all of them, but we definitely went deep down that rabbit hole about consciousness, about the different approaches. Is there consciousness in animals and plants? How it all works within our ecosystem of the world, how it works within us, who is driving the ship, as you will, who's behind the curtain. And that's what we really thrive to answer in this episode. Again, not sure if we did, but we definitely had a very enlightening conversation. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Frauke Sandig and Eric Black. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you, Alex.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I reached out to you because I saw your wonderful film, Aware, A Glimpse into Consciousness, and I felt that it would be a perfect conversation for the show, and really wanted to dig in deep. And your film is wonderful, by the way, and it digs into multiple layers of consciousness and asks a lot of big questions and answers a couple questions, but you're also left with questions at the end of films, which are always a good sign, keeps the conversation going. So I'll just dive in really quickly and just ask you, what in your opinion is consciousness?
Oh, that's an easy question.
It's a fairly simple question. Let's just start that one off right away.
It's just still the biggest mystery of the universe, and people like Einstein couldn't answer that question, but of course we can.
But they told me you guys were the best. Did they lie?
They may have lied to you, Alex. Yeah.
There was one film fund in Germany rejected the proposal with exactly that response. The directors failed to answer the fundamental question, what is consciousness? But then I protested and said Albert Einstein also didn't answer that, and in the end we did get that grant. But
one of the things you can say about the definition of consciousness is that it's the feeling of being something or something or someone, or it's this inner life that we have, that it's which differentiates us also from robots and other things. There's a feeling to being me rather than an object. And that's the best definition in terms of just giving you the parameters of what people are talking about when they're talking about consciousness or researching the origins of consciousness. Why does it feel like something to be Alex? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why do we have thoughts or feelings at all? Why aren't we just robots? Why does this gray matter give rise to feeling?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was Christoph Koch, our brain researcher, mm-hmm. in our film, consciousness is mainly subjective experience. And I think most of our protagonists, most of the researchers would agree with this very simple definition. If it's the plant researcher, who's just Monica Galliano, who is claiming that also plants do have subjective experience and that they're not just objects, that they can feel and perceive. And I think with this simple definition, which of course doesn't totally explain what consciousness is, but it's some orientation we could live with.
So, because I mean, obviously, like, you know, I was joking that this is like an easy question, but obviously it's not. It's a very difficult question. I mean, the concept of conscious and when we become conscious of who we are from when we're born, because when we're born, we're just a bunch of nerve endings almost, essentially just trying to absorb as much stuff as we can around our environment. Do you remember at what point did you realize when you were growing up that you're like, I'm somebody? I'm like the ego finally said, hey, you are Eric, you're Frank, I'm Alex. Do you remember that? Is there that moment? And what causes that moment? Again, another fairly simple question.
Well, I surely answered that.
I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure I know when I had that feeling. I mean, I can remember when I first, well, memories, but that's not what you're asking. I mean, and I mean, to take off on that a little bit, I was talking to somebody else about this. My first memory had to do with music, and that I can remember a Bach. It was in retrospect, I know that it was a Bach Brandenburg concerto, and I was looking at a chandelier, and it was late in the day. I was probably about 3 or 4, I think. Why that? Why that? I mean, I'm not sure that our film answers anything like that, but I find music as mysterious as consciousness, really. You know, it's things that connects us with, you know, music of the spheres, or why does a certain vibration get to me? Or, and the other question is, why doesn't it get to other people? Why, that's another thing that's in there, but we didn't do a documentary about music either, but it certainly was on the periphery of this entire thing also, that there are a lot of mysteries. But consciousness has, you know, it was the hard problem was rather well defined by Descartes back in 1630, and we really haven't gotten very much further with that. Now we have MRIs and we can scan what the brain is doing, but we don't know why it's doing that. I mean, it's lighting up colors that indicate that there's activity going on there, but we don't know. We really do not know what consciousness is.
Right. So with, you had 6 researchers in your film, and each of them going at this question differently. Can you kind of just quickly discuss the 6 researchers, who they are, and what's the angle that they were coming at this problem with?
Yeah, I mean, our approach was actually the 6 blind men and the elephant. It's an old Asian parable where 6 blind men are going out into the night and trying to find out what this big being is, and everybody touches a little other like the trunk, the foot, the ear, and describe it in a completely different way. And this was our approach to the film, to find 6 researchers who have absolutely different perspective on consciousness and different approaches. And
in the story, you know, I mean, we all know the story, but just because it's an important part, is that it's not until you come back and you have these 6 parts of the mosaic that the king or whoever it is realizes this must be an elephant.
Mm-hmm. And we also thought that consciousness is the only topic or object for research that you can approach from outside as well as from inside. So you can approach from outside as a scientist and research a brain or a plant or an animal, but you can also research it from inside, like a Buddhist who is meditating, or you're trying out psychedelic substances, and which you also can research from outside and inside. So we wanted both approaches. So we have one plant researcher who is investigating the consciousness of plants, which is Monica Galliano, a wonderful person also. And as a counterpart, we have an indigenous Maya woman who is actually experiencing plant consciousness on a different level, like on a dream level, and communicating with plants, so more from the inside. Then we have the brain researcher, famous brain researcher, Christoph Koch from the Allen Institute for Brain Science, the director or the chief scientist of the Allen Institute. And his counterpart is a famous Buddhist monk, Matthieu Ricard, who is the official translator for the Dalai Lama and lives in Nepal. And his passion is to investigate consciousness from inside. And then we have a big, big topic in the film is psychedelic research. Mm-hmm. And we've Roland Griffiths from the Johns Hopkins University, probably the leading scientist for psychedelic research, and has done mainly psilocybin research over the last years. And his counterpart from the inside is Richard Boothby, who is a philosophy professor and a participant in the study. So we have always thought to represent both perspectives for every topic and to approach it from all sides.
The other thing that's involved there is that we were looking for radically different perspectives. And that's how we started our looking in the first place. And with the idea, is there anything in common when you come back and you put these viewpoints together that tells us more about what consciousness is? Again, like the elephant story, and that's why we really went all over the world and very, very different perspectives. Rather, it's Christoph Koch with 300 scientists working under him and hard, what we call material science, to a Tibetan Buddhist monk who's researching consciousness, he would say scientifically, from the inside. He would say that's the only way you can research it. So each of them has their own method, I would say.
And angle and perspective. Yeah.
What I found fascinating was the researcher who researched plants on a scientific standpoint, where they were doing the research of, you know, how does the root find water. And they trick the root with the sound vibrations, and then you could just see them going there. Well, like, that is a level of consciousness. I mean, that is not just a brute object that just sits there like a rock or something. There's something there, but the question is, what is it, and what is that level versus the level of an animal versus the level of a human? Because we are all aware and have some sense of consciousness, but at a completely multiple levels. Like, a plant might be able to hear, which that kind of proved that it heard the sound of water, yet there was no water there. So it had some sort of, it was fascinating to me, but I saw that in the documentary where I saw there's plants, there's animals, there's humans, and each have a different level of consciousness at that level. But what is that? And what is it? What's the definition, not only for us, but for humans and for animals and for plants? Plants was never even in the conversation before.
Well, I'm uncomfortable with this idea of levels. I mean, I'm watching you move your hand up and down while you say that. And let's say maybe more important than what I have to say is Monica would say, well, careful right there. I mean, I think your audience was probably going to think, some of them are going to think this too. You know, our evaluation of their consciousness may not be valid at all. And then we could add whales and dolphins, and there's an sure. open question, rather they're not more intelligent than we are. Conscious than we are. But I think I'm uncomfortable with all of those terms in terms of level. I mean, plants have been here a lot longer than animals have on this planet. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously doing something right. I think our research into plants often says more about us than it says about the plants. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's only because you get, in this case, Monica Galliano, who is, we call her the Jane Goodall of plants. Mm-hmm. What Jane Goodall did back in 1961 is exactly where no one would have believed. You weren't even allowed, she said, when she was studying, I'm not sure if it was Oxford or Cambridge, that you weren't allowed at the time to even talk about the consciousness of animals. It was taboo. And she said she would go home and console herself with her dog. But 50 years later, we have Monica Galliano applying basically tests that have been being used for the last 50 years on animals and coming up with a lot of the same results. So it's not that plants have changed in the last 50 years. It's that we've bothered to look. I mean, that's what makes Monica who she is because she bothered to look. I mean, she had an inkling, like, why don't we do this? And she started out as a marine scientist, and she didn't want to kill any fish anymore. And she moved over to plants. And so she took a lot of the same experiments that she was doing with fish and applied them to plants. And that's why we know this, is because we bothered to look.
And there's also so much research recently been done also about the wood wide web, about cooperation in forests, about whole systems cooperate with each other. And I think it's now pretty mainstream to assume that there is consciousness in nature, even if it's not quite clear how it works. Because Monica always says, why should we measure plant consciousness from our human perspective? It's their plant way of perceiving and doing things. So why would they have to accept our human system? Or
they haven't evolved, fit in the same niche. Yeah. Why would they have the same consciousness? And how on earth are we going to measure that?
Yeah, and it's just, I guess instead of levels, it's just differences, because obviously our consciousness is different than animal consciousness, is different than plant consciousness. And then the question is, you know, the entire ecosystem of the world, like all of us working together, which is a good question. Why do you believe that we as humans always look at ourselves as separate from nature, separate from things, you know, in our environment where it's just so logical for anybody who has a brain to understand that we rely on nature, we rely on the world, we rely on our environment to live, but we're not separate from them. We're all connected, which then also goes to a larger question. Why do we separate ourselves as human beings? Because we're all connected as well.
Actually, this was the initiation for us was our last film about the Maya in Mexico and Guatemala. It was a film about the Maya of today and their spirituality, but also their problems with the destruction of their environment. And that was called Heart of Sky, Heart of Earth. And actually, Aware is a little bit of a continuation of this.
So it's the second part of the trilogy.
Yeah. And I mean, we remember both when Flori, a Maya spiritual guide, in an interview, she was very upset with us, not with us personally, but with everybody in the Western cultures. And she said, you white people, you always see everything as separated. Like, here's the house and here's the animal and here's the tree and here are you. And we indigenous people, we have always seen everything as connected and interconnected. And that was actually for us the first clue to investigate consciousness, and which finally, after many years now,
it's an answer to Flori's answer to Flori's question, which is also to say that, you know, Alex, you're saying, I mean, I know, you know, that's not probably what you're saying anyway, but when you say we as the human race or whatever that is, even then we're only talking about the last 12,000 years since agriculture. Mm-hmm. The rest of our history, which goes at least back 250,000 years, we were tribal people as well. We were hunter-gatherers and very much connected and very much have the idea that we are a part of nature. It's civilization and of course, at this point, it's, you know, our competitive corporate capitalism that has really just pulled us completely out of that fold.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Actually, Monica Galliano, it's exactly what she says in the film also, that we see the things as separate and we see things, not beings. And that is, this is the cause of our whole environmental crisis, because we see nature as something we can dominate and which is separate from us.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's a million, you know, good and bad movies that talk about that. But I find it so, I always find it fascinating that, and you know, I have these conversations, these kind of philosophical conversations with my colleagues about, you know, you were saying 12,000 years since basically agriculture, but in the last 200 years, the advances that our species has had is astronomical. It's growing at such a rate. Even in my lifetime, you know, I was born in the 70s. Mm-hmm. The world looks a lot different now than it did in the 70s. Let alone, like, my grandfather, before he passed, he lived through no electricity, or barely the beginnings of electricity, no airplanes, no cars, no tech. So all of this tech, what caused this speed up? We're talking about 250,000 years of being around, let's say, and then last 12,000 years agriculture. Then all of a sudden, the last 200-300 years, a major ramp up. I mean, at a level that our species has never had, which leads into, is consciousness have a part in that? Like, is there something going on that just, because did our brains change a lot in the last 1,000 years? Last 2,000 years? I mean, slightly, I'm sure, evolutionary, maybe. But overall, you could pluck somebody out from the days of Christ and have them be born in this time period, and they would go with the flow, as they say.
Well, as far as I know, the last genetic change to Europeans is the ability to digest milk, and that's 12,000 years ago. So we haven't changed at all since then. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I mean, of course, there are a lot of things, but I think a lot of us would say it's energy. That all of a sudden that you could put oil to work for us and have all of this energy really transform. I mean, I'm being simplistic, but it certainly is what put the power behind it, that you all of a sudden you could move things you could never have thought to have moved. I mean, it started with steam power, but it's really the last 150 years of the history of energy. And, you know, from burning wood to make steam, or to oil, and that's where we're also stuck, of course. But this is a long ways from consciousness, and maybe not the answer you're looking for, but I'm not at all sure. I mean, I'm not even sure how even to measure that, but I'm certainly not comfortable with the idea that we are more conscious than our tribal selves.
Right.
My tendency is, yeah, again, you're back to definitions, but I would feel very uncomfortable saying that I am more conscious than my Mayan, tribal Mayan counterpart.
I would argue that I think that indigenous people are more conscious because they're more connected to the planet than we are. We're much more detached. As a general statement, I'm being very general about this, but Western society is very mostly detached from nature. We are nature. We are part of this planet. We are part of this ecosystem. So to be, you know, we are looking at our iPhones. We're not looking at a tree. We're going deeper down that rabbit hole. And I think that's where there's so much depression and so much all this kind of stuff in regards of that. And I think that's why there is a movement towards understanding consciousness, understanding what's inside of us, to go inside for the answers as opposed to objects of outside. Is that a fair statement?
Just one word to the iPhone, because to me it always seems like a paradox that I think technically the world has never been more interconnected, because we are all so connected with everybody worldwide, with the internet and with our iPhones and Facebook, etc., etc. But on the other hand, I think there has never been so much loneliness, because everybody is just busy with his little machine. And I think this is a paradox which is very interesting, and which is, of course, different in societies who are still more connected with nature directly and with living beings directly.
Now, what part the spirituality play in consciousness? And because there definitely was conversations about that in your film. What is your opinion of that?
Well, there are really, in some ways, there are two parts of our film, mm-hmm. but probably more than that. And it's probably the thing that I least, going back to the elephant story, and that, because this was, it wasn't just for the film, it was also rather the way we approached it as two human beings approaching consciousness as well. And what I least expected was this quality of pure awareness or pure consciousness. I mean, these are words, and they're hard to define, but as someone growing up in Ohio in a working class neighborhood, I don't think I had any idea what pure consciousness was. I don't think I really have any. I mean, even now I'm struggling with trying to understand what that means. I mean, and it's something Buddhists have been telling us about. It's something that tribal peoples have been telling us about. And I've always thought that it's been very much of interest to me, but rather abstract, the idea that you could be in a state where you can separate your own identity, your own ego, from a self that's in back of that, is not something I ever expected to be talking about. Or even, frankly, I'm someone also who grew up very uncomfortable with New Age jargon. Mm-hmm. And to be even talking like this, I have to sort of breathe first before I do. Even having been, lived in San Francisco for a long, long time, it still makes me uncomfortable, this sort of hokey pokey, hocus pocus thing. But what was really fascinating about this film, I mean, one of the things that was really fascinating in this film was getting to the essence of what is pure awareness, what is pure consciousness, and that's certainly what the studies and Johns Hopkins are also about, even if it's not broadcast everywhere. It certainly is what the indigenous people are telling. It's certainly what Buddhism has been telling us forever. You can reach a state where you can meld with either a higher consciousness, rather that means with the universe, or rather it means with, in the case of Buddhism, it's the bodhisattva in us. Well, frankly, it's not something I ever expected to hear myself say.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it's, again, a point where the indigenous approach and the science approach meet, because psychedelic substances almost all come from indigenous medicines, which had been used for thousands of years. If it's been the magic mushrooms like psilocybin, peyote,
ayahuasca, right?
Yeah. And now science is really methodically more and more trying to research what indigenous peoples have used and known as medicine for a long, long time. And they're coming to amazing results, especially at, for example, the psilocybin studies at Johns Hopkins University, where they found that they get really amazing successes with healing of depression in their studies at this moment.
Well, even if I can, let me interject this, because I think it's important too, Alex, is that in these studies at Johns Hopkins, which I think a lot of people are very aware of now because they've been going on since 2000, there have been over, I think it's the last we count, it was 720 psychedelic trips, without one bad trip, by the way. But what is interesting about that is that we're getting to a what I'm trying to say is that all of this new, what we call the new science, I mean, I guess science is always calling itself new. But I think the other thing that really surprised us too is how close this new science, I mean, and not in every domain, but is merging with what indigenous people have been telling us forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's the consciousness of plants or animals, rather it's the strength and the possibility of touching on the divine yourself. These are all things that indigenous people have been saying in other words, and we haven't been able to hear them, but they've been telling us for a long, long time. Now, again, I don't want to make that overly simplistic as though it's, you know, this is just what our film is about, but it really struck us over and over while we were researching this film, is like, huh, this is very close to what the Maya had been telling us also.
Yeah, I've studied the Maya as well just for fun, and I've been down to Mexico, and I absolutely just love the culture. And I mean, they were doing obscene math while the Europeans were still crawling around. I mean, their calendar was more perfect than what we have in our computers at this point. So it was I always find it fascinating when science or, you know, current societies look back or even look at indigenous or look at past cultures like with like disdain, almost like, oh, look at those silly people, you know, pushing around rocks or something like that. But when you dig deeper, you realize they figured stuff out that we're starting to just grasp now. Right. Yeah, they didn't have an iPhone, but they didn't have the iPhone. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they were working on it when we came in.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, and what is it the first thing that we, and I'm meaning Europeans, did when we went to the Maya? We burnt 20,000 texts, and we outlawed the use of psychedelic medicine. I mean, what they would call and what I now would call psychedelic medicine. First thing we did.
So who's the barbaric one?
Yeah.
Who are the savages?
Well, even Cortez, now that we're having the 500th anniversary of Cortez invading Mexico, he was apparently asked if he would need a doctor from Spain. He said, hell no. The Aztecs are much better doctors than the Spanish are.
It's remarkable. The psychedelic experiments are going on in Johns Hopkins. You were talking about that it really is helping with depression. Mm-hmm. Can they pinpoint what is doing that? Is it an inner peace that they're finding when they go on these trips? Because they're obviously, I think, this is just my opinion, a psychedelic kind of is like a rocket ship or a speed train to finding what might take meditators
much longer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just like it opens the back door quickly. And you go in there really quickly, as opposed to maybe meditating for 10 years. I mean, that's just my look at it. But I'd love to hear what you guys think.
Well, Ram Dass is famous for saying that, you know, I think he was talking about LSD at the time. But he said that it'll get you in the room with Christ and Buddha for 15 minutes, but then you have to leave.
That's not a bad ticket if you can get it.
All right. Roland Griffiths says in our film that meditation is the tried and true course to investigate the nature of mind, and psilocybin is the crash course.
Yeah.
And he explains it it's not simple, but it's also not so difficult to understand. He says that usually our brain is in a default mode where only like three points are always communicating with each other, and
like screensaver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is just to survive your daily life, to get your food, to etc. etc. And under psilocybin, or also under a very long time meditation, this opens up, and suddenly many, many points in the brain are connected with each other and communicating with each other, and you have a completely different image. And he said in a depression, usually this default mode is even stricter. You have almost no variations. You just have a very narrow way of communicating points. And so by taking psilocybin, if this interconnection happens, it helps, even if the patient even just sees one time, gets another perspective, that there's another perspective possible, which takes him out of this narrow patterns.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how I understood it.
You could also call it ego.
Yeah.
That your ego, it's a little like being OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, where your world gets smaller and smaller. And that's, depression is very much, as now this is as I understand it. And as documentary filmmakers, we're at the, you know, at the mercy of our subjects to know anything. But this is how I understand it from the studies in London and the studies in Johns Hopkins, is that your world gets very tiny and it's very restricted. And you sort of just, you're like a rat in a cage. You're just banging into things. And all of a sudden on psilocybin, and you can see this is what they're doing in the brain scanners, is that, which our film also shows, is that all of a sudden every part of your brain is lighting up and talking to all the other sections of the brain. And the interesting thing is it's also using less energy than when you're normal. And the other thing that it looks like, besides meditating Buddhists who have 40 years of experiences or more with meditating and psilocybin, is small children who have not yet formed their ego have a very similar brain pattern or connections pattern in their brains.
They're all still, everything is communicating and interconnected and not restricted.
Before it's all shut down.
And what is, just one last thing to add, what is also interesting is that Roland Griffiths, as a researcher, claims that these substances don't make you addicted from them, because not like antidepressants, because it's just the help of even just knowing that there is a different perspective possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing, I mean, to answer, go back to your question, Alex, like, why would this make you less depressed? I think that, I mean, that's very hard to say. I mean, and this is actually what I wanted to say before, and when I lost my train of thought there, and that is that 79 or almost 80% of the people who have participated in these studies, these are people with no previous drug experience, which is hard to find in the U.S., I suppose, but 79% report this 4 to 5 hour session as being one of the 5 most important experiences of their lives, on par with the death of a parent or the birth of a first child. I mean, that's the scale we're talking about. Wow. So it's not just that their brain is, you know, able to see every other part. They're having an experience which, the most common term that people use is that's more real than reality. This is an expression which gets used because everyone has to keep a diary that goes in there, the psychonauts, as they're called, has to keep a diary. They are using this expression and coming back, I think, more than anything, and my feeling about what I'm reading is that with a sense of awe and wonder that, you know, to use language out of the 60s, has blown their mind, that they've seen something far greater than ourselves. And they've connected with something, again, nebulous language, but far greater than ourselves. And the last point I wanted to make here is that 40%, a full 40% of the people who are involved in these studies say that it was the single most important experience of their lives, 40%. Now, something is going on there that is hardly explicable in our normal day-to-day.
So if I may use the analogy, you were saying a couple of points. So when you're depressed, you're basically in a game of Pong, which is a little dot going back and forth, hitting 2 bars. And then when you go down this road, it's like going into virtual reality. It's that extreme of a different experience. I mean, because as video gamers out there listening, play Pong and then go into virtual reality and your experience is going to be much, much more, much different. But it's interesting though that you're saying that once they go in, they are connecting to something a higher place or something larger than themselves, which I think that I think in a weird way, most human beings are always looking to be part of something bigger than themselves, that they're not alone, that they are part of a larger, and that could be family at a smaller level. That could be community. That could be the world. That could be the work that they do and trying to help other people. But this is, again, the crash course, as you're saying.
Well, I would say we're really hungry. Yeah. Hunger. And I feel that in myself. I don't want to, you know, pull myself out of that. I feel a real hunger for a connection to something bigger. And also someone who grew up very skeptical of Orthodox religion at the same time.
But what I find still the most fascinating but also most inexplainable part is that so many people, I mean, as Roland Griffiths says in this Johns Hopkins study, experience something they would call the divine or a higher consciousness or something very benevolent. And they get the feeling that there is something that endures after death, that there is not really death. And there is some higher consciousness that is accompanying you. And this is a big percentage of people who would have claimed to be atheists before. This part, Warren Griffiths himself says he cannot explain it, but it's just a result of his studies that so many people report this religious or spiritual experiences.
He said, Roland says that they really had no idea what they were touching on. When people came back, these people came back with saying, you know, this was one of the most important experiences of my life. He said, you know, I've worked in the halls of Johns Hopkins for 40 years. I haven't had a single experience here that was one of the most important of my life. These people must have really dull lives. But, you know, no, I mean, this is something that's going on again with normal, as far as they can get, normal everyday Americans are having these experiences, which they are not expecting at all. And they're having to use language which they haven't used before either. And again, I'm one of them who's very uncomfortable with this language. I don't know how to use it. And I have to, because this is the information that I'm getting through our film. But it's startling. Really startling.
Another experience many people have is an experience of homecoming. So that they come to a place which they have always known, which doesn't even surprise them, because it's more like they always had known it but forgotten it. Mm-hmm. So this homecoming experience is also, I mean, it's a scientific study with hundreds of people. Obviously, it's very frequent.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the things you're saying echo, you know, echo gurus from India and, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, and like a lot of these concepts now that are now being just barely skimmed in the scientific world has been in spiritual texts for you know, thousands of years sometimes. And because as you're saying these things, I'm like, the homecoming, got it. So you're going back, you've forgotten all this stuff, which turns into the question I have now is consciousness basically another word for looking for the soul? Is the soul can those two words be exchanged? Because I mean, you did talk to a lot of spiritual people in your documentary, as well as scientific people, and like you're saying, they're finding a common ground, which is fascinating. And these conversations, like, could you imagine these conversations in the 30s or 40s? Like, people would look at you like you were crazy. But yet now we're getting to that place where we're getting to that. So do you think that the word soul or consciousness can be intertwined or exchanged?
Probably not everybody would agree, but even Christoph Koch, the famous brain researcher, says he had been a materialist, but now he would call himself a panpsychist, which means actually that soul is everywhere in nature. And in this case, he uses it almost synonymously with consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is really, I mean, and it's not that we talked to a lot of spiritual people and a lot of scientists. What was interesting to us is, well, four of our six protagonists are hardcore scientists. Mm-hmm. It's that they have another aspect to them as well, as you find in a lot of very high-powered scientists. It's not, they're not all autistic. That they, you know, even Christoph Koch, I mean, I keep coming back to him because he's in that position. He's got 300 scientists working under him. He was researching consciousness before with Francis Crick, the discoverer of DNA. I mean, this is high powered stuff.
Yeah, and they are actually working now on making an atlas of the brain, of human brain and mouse brain. So this is pure material at this level.
Yeah,
right.
But still goes further in his own philosophy and thinking.
And he would say that he now doubts, you know, and this is someone who has access to everything that's going on in the research, in the scientific research into the neurons of the brain, that we're not going to find the origins of consciousness in the human brain. Mm-hmm. Now, that's quite a statement.
That's insane. That's really from one of the leading scientists on the planet in this field.
Yeah. 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 That's insane. I mean, that doesn't mean that there aren't people who don't believe that we will find science. I mean, the origins of consciousness.
But may I add something?
Go right ahead. Yeah.
No, just thinking that Christoph Koch in our film also quotes the famous Nobel Prize winner Max Planck, who is the father of quantum physics. And Max Planck said already in the 20s that for him consciousness is fundamental and you cannot go behind consciousness, and everything that is matter is derived from consciousness, which is an absolutely revolutionary thing to say for a physicist.
Does mm-hmm. consciousness fundamental and everything else is secondary? I mean, this sounds like right out of out of Hinduism, the
The Bhagavad Gita, of course, and it does, and that's what it's so fascinating with.
Go ahead. The heart. Scientist. I mean, does it get any more hardcore than Max Planck? And here he is, you know, amazing, amazing.
It is. It's remarkable. And, you know, when you start delving into quantum mechanics and quantum physics, where now they, you know, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to my understanding, they've gone down now so deep into the cells that when they finally get to the deepest place they can be, they're like, there's space between the, yeah. There's
atom. Yeah.
Yeah. So now before they thought atoms were solid or something, but it's actually not. We're not solid beings. Everything is not solid on a quantum level. And now we're going deep. So then it's like, well, what's holding us together? Is the question.
String theory. I mean, string, one of the possibilities. But just consider the fact that that's a possibility. There is no matter. Mm-hmm. It's just forces holding points, which have no space, mm-hmm. together in space. Well, I mean, even consider the Big Bang. I mean, how do you explain, I mean, never mind spirituality, just the science of the Big Bang, which is, I wouldn't want to say it's verifiable, but it's one of the most solid theories we have. Mm-hmm. That everything in the universe was originally smaller than the size of an atom. You know, I mean, the mind, you can't even say the mind boggles because you can't even go there. But it's just to say, so, I mean, we know E equals MC squared. So it's all energy? Well, obviously, but Then you want to get behind, and I'm not even going to pretend to know, Alex, but you want to know what's behind energy, you know, and that's what Max Planck is saying. Behind energy, behind matter, is consciousness. I mean, this is pretty close to an idea of God, maybe with a small g instead of a big G. Mm-hmm. And again, these are terms I feel uncomfortable.
I can see that you're uncomfortable saying this is what I find so fascinating, Eric, is that you come from a place that is that, like you said, you didn't grow up thinking about this. You grew up in San Francisco, which is, I've been to San Francisco. It is as free spirit and new age as any place on the planet. I think they created the term New Age. I think it all started from Berkeley back in the 60s. So
well, I went to Santa Cruz for as well. So, you know, but I say, just to correct you a little bit, Alex, I grew up in working class Ohio.
Right.
I didn't move until I went to Berkeley to go to. Gotcha. No, I was there as a child, but I grew up in Ohio, working right. class Ohio. And we didn't talk about this at all.
No, and but I find it so fascinating that through your own research and your own experiences, the facts that are coming to you from people who are, you know, some spiritual, but mostly hardcore scientists who are saying, you know, there might be something else here. Like, what's behind energy? That is an insane question to ask, because it's like, what's behind matter? Like, what's holding it all together? And then you start getting into these really deep rabbit holes of like, what's controlling, like what's holding everything together? Is there a higher power? Is there a higher energy? You know, and that's what I find fascinating about this conversation. That's why I loved your movie so much, is that these hardcore scientists, and I find that the harder core scientists, and didn't Einstein, Einstein towards the end of his career as well, his life was talking about these kind of ideas in a time where,
although he had a hard time with quantum physics
but
until the end of his life.
But he definitely had the awe of nature.
He wasn't like, oh, that's a tree, the hell with it. No, he started like, because... And if I may quote Einstein, oh, there's a tree, the hell with it. you could quote me on that. No, but as you as scientists go deeper down that rabbit hole, the answers that they're getting is uncomfortable for them, and they're like, well, wait a minute. If this is the case, maybe I've been wrong. And I've noticed that with harder, like people who are at a very high level, like you're saying, top people in the world, in their fields, are starting to find these, like quantum mechanics, string theory. I mean, that's unheard of back in, you know, when in the early parts of physics in general, concepts of physics.
Also, that some people, you know, Bohm, for example, took off on this. Niels Bohr took off on this. I mean, it wasn't to say any, but what is amazing and what verifies what you're saying, though, Alex, is that quantum physics has been around 121 years. It's not new. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most verifiable theories that we have. We don't know why it works, but we do know that it works. I mean, that's the killer. And it's even now, though, we're having a hard time. I mean, it's only been recently applied to biology. Mm-hmm. I mean, photosynthesis is because of quantum physics. I mean, we didn't know that. We now know that birds orient themselves because of quantum mechanics. We didn't know that until very, very recently, because no one was even looking there.
But Monica Galliano, the plant researcher, says that there is still a lot of resistance in a traditional science against new ideas, for example, that plants are conscious. Because she said she made so many experiments with plants which showed that they learn, that they perceive, hear, see, interconnect, intercommunicate. And she said there are so many scientist colleague who didn't even talk to her anymore just because of these ideas. And she said they never said that her data were wrong. They always said just this beef.
They were uncomfortable. They are uncomfortable with the facts, which
they weren't. But they weren't going after her experiments. That was interesting. They were saying, you can't do that. You cannot. It cannot be possible. We're not even going to talk to you. And yet the type of experiments she was doing were like Pavlov's dog, that you could train a plant to respond to a pea plant to respond to a noise, even when you took the impetus for it to turn away and only had the noise, the pea turns around just like a dog. It's the same experiment that we do on dogs or the one, you know, she's famous for doing the dropping the mimosa plants, which are the plants that fold up, their leaves fold up when they, we presume, feel fear or feel threatened. and she would drop them 6 inches, a whole bunch of them at a time, yeah, in a case. And you know, after a very short while, they don't close up their leaves anymore. Not only that, you do that a month and a half, they still don't go back to closing up their leaves. They've learned that that's not a threat. Whereas you jiggle them or do something else, they'll close right back up.
And so, they remember and learn.
They remember, they learn.
It makes my head hurt. I'm not a scientist, and I'm like, my God, I can't even conceive that plants have these abilities. Which, I mean, you could just look at a sunflower, a basic sunflower. It follows the sun.
Right.
It literally just moves during the day. That is not a blunt object. There's something there. What is it?
Previously, we would have presumed that that has to do with something going on in the heat and the,
sure,
you know, having to do with the sun. And I, frankly, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't even know that that's not true. I mean, you may be able to verify that. But what the other things that we can show about plants definitely put a lot of emphasis on the fact that this is a conscious being. We don't know in how it's consciousness. We don't even know, you know, we can show that plants see. We have no idea how this happens. Yeah.
But I do think that plants orient themselves to light. That's basic. And I think that was actually the base of Monika's Pavlov experiment, that the instead of the dinner, which the dog gets, the plants get blue light. Mm-hmm. And she associated with a little fan. And so always when the fan showed up and made a little wind and noise, they got the light. And after a while, the plants bent over, even when no light was there, and there was just the fan. So they're making an association. And it's not really it's not really explainable with the means the science has today, but she was just demonstrating that they're doing it.
That's simple, very simple experiments.
No, and you know, we talked about meditation a little bit, and I've talked about meditation heavily. I'm a fairly heavy meditator on a daily basis as well, and it's changed my life. And apparently, according to my blood work, has changed my blood work as well.
Meditate. I'll be right back.
My nutritionist was checking my blood work the other day, and she's like, how is your this level? I forgot what it was. She's like, how is your level of this where it's at? Do you take a supplement for that? I go, no, I don't take a supplement for that. She's like, do you meditate? I go, yeah, I'm a fairly heavy meditator. And she's like, that's it. It is you're creating that chemical in you, and your levels are like, and it's like dropping the cholesterol. And like, it's fascinating. And meditation is one of the most studied things for the last, I don't know how many years. There's so many peer-reviewed studies.
Transcendental meditation. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fairly amazing. So my question to you is, what part did you find that meditation plays with finding that deeper part of yourself, that thing, whatever that thing is in the experiments at Johns Hopkins, that's the crash course? Can meditation is that same path, it's just not as fast. But what did you find in your findings?
You're looking at me, I presume, the guy from Ohio.
The guy from Ohio who probably didn't meditate when he was 15.
Right. Well, I have to be really honest and mm-hmm. say that I've had a love of Buddhism since I was probably about 20. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. That means reading about Buddhism. I wouldn't say that I was a Buddhist, or let's put it this way. It's a little like Groucho Marx, never belong to a club that will have you as a member. But it's sort of the opposite, because I'm not sure that I would qualify as a Buddhist. But I certainly, there are a lot of the tenets in Buddhism, and it's certainly also it's the way that it dovetails with quantum physics, for one thing, is really impressive to me. But I have to say, I've been very frustrated with meditation. I think I was trying to describe it to myself today. It's almost like I'm an OCD thinker, you know, that I've got so many thoughts in my mind. And I, meditation helps me without a doubt. You know, it, often when I have problems, especially when I have problems, especially about 4 o'clock in the morning, I'll go meditate and I'm able to sort of watch the thoughts go by and I'm able to say, okay, that's, you know, we can deal with that. Or, but in terms of getting to the next level in Buddhism or in meditation, I've been very frustrated with it. And I think that that's one of the things that really interests me personally, although I don't have much experience with something like psilocybin, is that once you've been, as Ram Dass said, in that room for 15 minutes, you have a little idea where you're going. You even to know that this is possible. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get onto this too, because I'm going to jump back for a minute to what you said about connecting to something that's bigger. Well, I think that that's maybe the as I said before, but it's a good time to say it again. What amazed me most was the fact that you can touch upon this something bigger. I mean, I'm not going to say that I know what it is. I hope I never do. I mean, I hope that that sense of awe never leaves me. But I distinctly have that feeling, and I also am looking at it in the feeling of all of these participants to the John Hopkins studies, not to mention meditating Buddhists, who are all telling this, that they're touching, I mean, again, language is a problem here, but they're touching on the divine. Mm-hmm. They're hitting a something spiritual, something out there, pure consciousness, pure awareness, whatever word you want to use, God. Again, these are words I feel very uncomfortable with, but obviously there's, as you said, something going on there. And I'd like to introduce another point too, and this is also coming from Ohio. What I'm also stunned with is, you know, I wouldn't have even conceded any of these things until I'm over 60. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? That I didn't even know about this until I'm 60. What I mean is that I think that we need to start talking about this ability or this possibility of connecting to the divine as our birthright. Mm-hmm. This is our birthright. And no one should be able to take that away from you. This is part of what it means to be conscious and to be at least human, if not many other things. And that has been taken away from us, and we need to get it back. And I can say that for myself also personally. I want that connection. I need that connection. I'm hungering for that connection. And that's a lot of what our film is about, is not only these material sciences doing their science and showing that these things that we thought weren't conscious beforehand are consciousness. It also follows you into their own personal journey, spiritual journey, and to show you that they're frustrated with material science, that they, like me, they love science, they read all about it, they're obviously extremely well-informed, and on the other hand, they know that it's a method, and it's limited what science can do, and I think it's like with me, I'm holding on to the handrail of science because I trust science. But I want to go into that other thing that's much bigger than that, at least holding on. And that's what our film tries to do. It's a provocation for people who've never really thought, people like me, who've never really thought about this before, because we need it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, more so, I think, than ever before. Now I'm going to ask you a couple of questions I ask all my guests. What do you think your mission is here in this life?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I don't think I'm ever going to be enlightened. That's my, I'm going to give that up. I'm going to sacrifice myself this time around. Right. I've noticed this ever since I was a little kid, and I think this explains how I became a documentary filmmaker, really, is that nothing gets me motivated more than injustice. Mm-hmm. no matter where it is, whether it's racism, sexism, whether it's the genocide of what we call Indians in Guatemala or Chiapas, or frankly, what's going on in Afghan, the that we just botched in Afghanistan big time, that injustice is, I don't know how that is, but even as a little kid, I was the one who thought that Joey, who was a little handicapped, should be able to play basketball with the rest of us in Columbus, Ohio, you know, where we don't let just anybody in, especially in football. I was always that way. I was always that way. And I have to think that that has something to do with my core and why I make films to this day is injustice and trying to get to what I perceive as truth.
Well, I mean, I think my mission is really to make documentary films to give ideas and people and stories a room and have voices heard that might not be heard otherwise. And I would try to pull myself pretty back. I mean, I never show up in front of a camera or make my own films or so. I just want to allow these ideas to get into the world. And of course, it's an incredible privilege also to meet all these people. I mean, to live for years with the Maya, for example, and to absorb these ideas and to have a chance to transport these ideas into a more public space. I really have the feeling that that is my mission. And I sometimes also think it's not coming from inside me. There is something also leading me, which I could not tell you what it is. Sometimes also all sort of strange coincidences happen, which lead me to meet certain persons and follow a certain story. And I couldn't even explain in the beginning why that is, but it always happens. So, and even like when big obstacles come across, also this film, there were like 10 situations where we thought there's no funding, we have to give up, this film will never be made. And then suddenly something very strange happened and it went on. So so somehow I do believe that is also a mission that is a little bit bigger than I am. So it's coming from somewhere else and things that need to be transported. It's more like a medium, maybe not in a spiritual sense, but
right. which again goes back to the question: what's behind? Who's behind the door? Who's behind the energy? What is guiding this? I think everybody, regardless if you are from Ohio or if you're from Berkeley, will admit that there's moments in life that you're like, that was a hell of a coincidence. Like, I just ran into that person and they, oh, that. And like, it just, it's almost too perfect. And you couldn't plan it almost. It's like, it'd be difficult or impossible to plan meeting people like that. Like, if you would have told me, you know, 10 years ago, I'm like, oh, you're going to be talking to amazing people on a daily basis through a microphone in your room on this thing called a podcast, I would have said, what are you talking about? And yet it's transformed my life and transformed everything that I've ever wanted in my life, basically by giving back to my communities that I've chosen to give back to. So it is, you know, we won't answer the mysteries of life in this conversation. So like the German grand people, you did not answer. You did not answer what is consciousness, so I cannot give you the grant.
We don't want to give the ending away.
People still have to see the film if we say it now.
Well, I mean, you're holding back because of that. Got it.
Back to you then, Alex. Yeah. What surprised you most in the film, you personally?
Me personally, what I found the most surprising was the consciousness of plants. There's another movie called The Hidden World of Trees, I think it's called. And it goes down this world of, like, you know, there's like almost like mothers and saplings and they protect them. And if you start analyzing how they are laid out in the forest, like that's how
radioisotopes.
It's so that world to me is really interesting. When I saw when I saw that sign, I forgot her name again, but that scientist, when she did the pee experiment.
Oh, Monica Gallina.
Monica. When I saw her do the pee experiment, I was just like, what? Like, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. It's honestly not like I'm completely blown away, but I am completely blown away. So it's kind of like that, like when you're inside the room with Jesus and Buddha, you're like, oh, I've been here before. It's a homecoming. That kind of information to me was surprising at one level, but not surprising at another, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Sure.
And there was a lot of that in your movie where revelations that were coming up by talking to the scientist were surprising and yet not surprising, for me at least. And that's how I approach when I watched the film. I saw that. But the plant experiment, when I saw it, I was just like, that's something I just hadn't seen before. I've never seen anything like that before. I never thought about it. Kind of like her colleagues are like, I don't even want to talk. No, I don't want to go into that room. That's a scary room. Because if I go into that room, that means I'm going to have to think about a lot of things that I just don't want to think about. And that's, I think, a reaction that so many people have to a lot of the concepts in your film, but also having conversations about consciousness. This conversation is probably going to blow a few people's minds. And then if they watch your film, we'll take them to another place. It's like some people don't want to leave the room that they've built for themselves. They're scared to go outside that door, and they don't want to believe that there's something outside. That's why meditation, in many ways, for me, it took me a long time to get into meditation. I was like you. It was hard. I kept bumping into walls. My mind was constantly, and I tried meditating probably for the last 20 years. I try on and off. I'm like, that's not doing anything for me. It's just not for me. Mm-hmm. And then about 5 years ago, I went in, and then I just kept going. And then I was like, oh, okay, this is how it works. And then it just started, and I just kept doing it. And I just made a conscious effort of like, I'm going to just keep doing it every day. And it started off with 5 minutes. And then I think my record now is 3.5 hours in one setting. You know, my goal is to do an 8-hour stretch. But I have kids, so that's probably not going to happen in the next 10 years. But maybe one day I'll go on a retreat somewhere in Nepal and do that. And then I found the benefits of it and finding the – and the thing that's always found – you and you said this in our conversation, which is that when you have a problem, those problems either go away or answers come to you. And I've – in my meditations, when I have a major life issue, I'll go in, I'll ask the question, and the answer presents itself, whether in one or two sessions. And I know a lot of meditators who have that thing. And it's hard for people who aren't meditators – to understand that. And it's scary because a lot of people were raised thinking that they were out, that everything is outside of themselves. They have a really difficult, as you use the term, I feel very uncomfortable saying that I have the answers inside of me, because that goes against everything I was ever taught through my community, through my family, through my religion, whatever. It's scary to a lot of people, but once they open that door, it doesn't conflict with any of that stuff. It adds to it. And that's that's what I try to do with this show, is to try to give a lot of different points of view about spirituality, about consciousness, about meditation, about answering those big questions that I pose to you guys. Like, why are we here? What is the purpose of all of this? How are we moving around? Like, these are big questions. You know, is this all there is another question that I ask constantly in this. Like, is it just me working 9 to 5? For 40 years and then, you know, retiring, and then maybe I can get to 65, and then maybe last 5 years go to a couple cruises. I mean, the old mentality is like, you know, you retire at 65, which now doesn't even make sense to me. And then you go off to a cruise, and then, you know, maybe you die in 5 years and you worked all your life. I'm sorry.
Sorry, our doorbell rang.
Oh, no worries. It's all good. But anyway, to answer your question. But I absolutely adored your film, and that's why I wanted to have you guys on. When I saw the trailer for it, I was like, I want to reach out to them. I'd love to see the film. And funny enough, how did that trailer come across my path?
Yes.
I mean, you're not Marvel. You're not Marvel. You're not spending $200 million on marketing. So, like, how did that come into my path? And then how did that trailer trigger me to go, I'm going to reach out to them because I want them to talk about it on my show? And then after this conversation gets released, what effects will it have on people listening? Which is something I've discovered in my world doing podcasting for 6 years. I can never underestimate the power of a conversation, how it will affect somebody else's life halfway around the world or completely around the world. It's remarkable. And the same thing with your film. Someone will watch this film and their life will be altered. Their life will be altered forever after they watch this film. And somebody listening to this conversation, and I've had these conversations with people. Like, I meet them at events and they'll look at me and they're like, Alex, I listened to that conversation, or I heard you say this, and it changed my life. And that's very, very powerful. And that's what drives me to do what I do.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Of course, of course. And when is the film going to be released in the U.S.?
The film will be released in the U.S. by September 24. Mm-hmm. I think starting in Los Angeles in the Lemle Theaters.
Yes.
And then it will go to New York, October 8th, Village Cinema. And I'm looking most forward to the premiere in Baltimore, because all our protagonists, like Roland Griffiths, Rick Boothby, Mary Cosimano,
Justin Fritz,
they will come to this event on October 13th in Baltimore. But it will be theatrically released nationwide.
Yeah,
we're very grateful for that.
By the same people who brought you Fantastic Fungi.
It's the same. Kurt Eftekar
we feel very fortunate.
And we also have a website. It's just aware-film.com.
You're asking me as though I would know.
No, you don't say minus in English, no?
Minus, dash.
Yeah. We'll put it in the show notes so people can definitely find it. And where can people...
Glimpses of Consciousness.
And where can people find your work and your other films?
Well, you can find it on that website, or we have a very small company. It's called Umbrella Films, and that's umbrellafilms.org.
Yeah.
And there we have some information about our other films, like Heart of Sky, Heart of Earth.
Yeah, the first in the trilogy, Heart of Sky, Heart of Earth, which is...
The film about the Maya.
We spent 3 years with the Maya, and that's...
Oh, my God. I look forward to watching that film as well.
Where only the indigenous Maya speak. There's no narration. It's just them speaking. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, listen, guys, I truly appreciate you coming on the show. It has been a wonderful conversation. I can't wait for this to go out into the world and see what good it can do. So I appreciate what you're doing and the work you're doing. So thank you so much, guys.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Like I said at the beginning of this episode, I don't think we're going to have the answers to the mysteries of life in one podcast episode. But hopefully, as we continue to have these conversations, it will shine a little light on the question. And maybe, just maybe, we'll start to begin to see the whole elephant as opposed to just small pieces of it. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch Aware, Glimpses of Consciousness, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/015. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and leave a good review for the show wherever you're listening to it. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, trust the journey. It is there to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.